It is good to be with you this morning. If you are visiting with us, we're glad you're here. I hope that you will stick around and let us get to know you a little better. We'll be in Genesis chapter 37 this morning. Genesis chapter 37. And there will be nothing on the screen. We're just going to work our way through the chapter today. So if you'd like to follow along in Genesis 37, if you have your own Bible, or there's some in the seats in front of you maybe, or if you take out your phone and promise not to play Angry Birds or Solitaire or anything like that, you can follow along on your high-tech Bible too. Beginning in verse 1, Jacob. And if you'll remember, if you've been here for the last several weeks or if you've not, Jacob is one of the sons of Isaac. Jacob is kind of known as a deceiver several times throughout his story, where he tries to gear things in the story to go his way, and he tries to take control of situations rather than trust in God. And I think you will see some of those things passing on a generation here in chapter 37. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. And this is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Joseph is a son of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel. And Jacob has these two wives, Leah and Rachel. We talked a little bit about them last time, about how Jacob was fooled into marrying Leah, and then he went on to marry Rachel. Leah had all these children. Rachel was not able to, and then eventually Rachel came around and had kids. And when she did, because she was the favorite, the kids also became favorites too. And Jacob had this struggle with liking one more than another and showing that love for one more than another. And we start to see Joseph's role in this whole thing too, which is Joseph is the spy. Joseph is the tattletale. Joseph is the one who goes out and watches what is done and then reports back to dad on it, which if you're dad is probably pretty handy, but if you're the other siblings, you're not too pleased with that guy. I mentioned a few weeks ago that my wife and I were on a date one time and we got a text, and that text said, "Whatever David tells you, it's not true." And we realized that the kids were at home not enjoying one another's company at the time, and something was going on, and we were about to start hearing reports about it. And we didn't put one of them in a place to say, tell us everything that goes wrong. But we start to see in this story that I think Jacob almost relishes this role that Joseph is going to have, because he gets a little more of the inside dirt about what's happening with the kids. And in this case, he brings back a bad report. Now Israel, verse 3, loved Joseph more than any other sons. Now, and we realize here that a lot of siblings feel like there's a favorite. And if I were to ask you this morning, and I won't, so keep your hands down, but if I were to ask you, are you the favorite in your family? There would probably be some of you that could raise your hands. And if I said, is your sibling the favorite of the family? There would probably be others of you that might raise your hands. Here we have the question answered for us. Yes, Joseph was loved more. He was loved more than the other kids. Because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. Now, richly ornamented robe doesn't do a whole lot for us, but if you could imagine everyone sitting around at Christmas time, and everyone is getting their gifts, and you get something that's just kind of so-so, and your brother or sister gets something that's unbelievable, the thing you have always dreamed of, and how that would feel. Now, in our house at Christmas time, we have a spreadsheet. And that's because my wife's an accountant. This is how we do things. We have a spreadsheet, and that spreadsheet says David at the top of one column and Nathan at the top of the other column. And there is the list of each thing that they have received. And there are also price values out next to it on the spreadsheet. We have to delete these after Christmas so they never find them. But anyway, there's all these things, and we try to make sure that things are equal. And there came a point where, because David was slightly older than Nathan, and Nathan still liked toys, and David was beginning to like things that were more expensive, that we explained to David, you are going to open less things this Christmas morning, but we spent the same amount of money on you, almost to the penny, that we did on your brother, and you have to understand that things here are equal. In the household of Jacob, things were not equal. There was a good gift, and there were average gifts in their minds, and Joseph was getting the good stuff, and the other brothers were not. When his brothers, verse 4, saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him. They hated him. And hate drives us to do things we would not do otherwise. And hate drives us to lose sight of the thought process that we would have otherwise. They hated him, but beyond hate, they could not speak a kind word about him. It's a level of hate that I hope is difficult for most of us to comprehend. Because as much as we may dislike someone, and I hope we don't camp there and spend a lot of time there, but generally you can find some good in them at some level. I'm a big college football fan. I'm an Alabama guy, for those who are visiting. For everybody else, you surely recognize at this point. Nick Saban is our coach. Nick Saban is loved or hated, depending on who you're a fan of, it seems like. Now, before Nick Saban was our coach, he was coaching the NFL for a little while, and then before that, he was the coach of LSU. I did not like him when he was the coach of LSU, because he was the coach of the other guys. Now that he's the coach at Alabama, he has a statue there. They wouldn't have done that before. People in Alabama really like that guy a lot, unless they're Auburn fans, Claxtons, if you're here. And there is this love-hate kind of thing. But even looking at him when he was a coach at LSU and not necessarily caring for the guy, I could look at him and say, that guy really knows what he's doing. There's still some kind of positive in there. But for Joseph and his brothers, they have lost all sight of the positive of Joseph. They can't look at him and say, well, at least he's loyal to Dad. They couldn't look at him and say, well, at least he really does, you know, keep an eye out on what's going on and report back. They look at him and they say, we hate that guy. We really just don't like that guy at all. Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. Joseph doesn't help himself out here with what he tells them, but he says to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed to it. And his brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Now, if you're not beginning to see the irony in this story, what we talked about with Jacob a week or two ago now was how Jacob went about stealing the birthright of his brother. How Jacob went about fooling his father into giving him the blessing that was due his brother. And now we have this brother, this son of Jacob, brother of his brothers, that has this dream and shares it, and they are mad about the very thing that their father actually did it in a deceitful kind of way. Joseph doesn't learn a lot from this encounter. He had another dream in verse 9. And he told his brothers, listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. He's all about these dreams of folks bowing down. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him. And he said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come to you and bow down to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him. But his father kept these things in mind. Now, his father, it's actually sunk through to the level a little bit of, what does all this mean exactly? All this language of dreams and visions and what does it all mean? But at the same time, he realizes, Joseph, you got to quit telling these kinds of stories because they don't like you already. And this is just going to continue to get worse for you. But after a while, in verse 12, now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. And we start to realize it's probably not just Joseph going out watching the brothers and telling Dad what's happening. It's actually probably Dad sending Joseph out for that purpose. This is what he does. I'm going to send little brother to watch big brothers. And this is going to go great, and he's going to see what they're doing, he's going to report back, and then when they get into trouble for what they're doing, they're going to know exactly where it came from. He sends them out for this purpose. So he said to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? And he replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks? They moved on from here, verse 17, the man answered. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan, but they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. How far does the hate have to go? How much does it have to ferment before you find yourself at this level? This is why, by the way, I always debate when there's something going on in the world around us of what things are worth interacting with and what things I just want to steer clear of. That's why I can't steer clear of the one we talked about this morning. How long can we let hate sit there and ferment before it develops into this? A man in that crowd yesterday drove his car through people. The second image that disturbed me, other than the guy carrying the cross in the name of Christ there, protesting race, was the image of this car going into a crowd and literally someone flying through the air after they had been hit. And I thought to myself, how much hate has to be in your heart for that to be okay? And I think we find something like that here in chapter 37. How much hate has to be in your heart when you look at your brother and say, I want something for my brother, I want him dead. That's what I want. That's what's going to make our lives better. That's what's going to rid us of this trouble that we have. I want him dead. And not only does one brother have that thought, but that thought begins to collect in the other brothers who are there, and there is not a voice initially speaking out against it. This sounds like a good plan. When we continually surround ourselves with people that hate at this level, it doesn't take us to places we want to go. Now, these brothers begin to speak out. There is one voice of dissension. Now, my guess would be, with the one voice of dissension, if people are like people are, there are three other ones without the guts to say anything. They're just sitting there waiting to see which way the crowd goes, pointing a finger up to the wind, seeing where the wind will blow, checking the poll numbers, however you want to put it. They're just sitting there waiting to see what's going to happen. And then one speaks up. Reuben heard this. He tried to rescue him from their hands. Now, I like that it's set in the idea that he tries to rescue, but at the same time, what I want the attempt to rescue to be is, what is wrong with you people? He's our brother. And as much as you may not like what he's doing, as much as you may think he is entitled, as much as you may think he doesn't understand us, as much as you may think he's the favorite and he's just dad's mouthpiece here to find out what we're doing, he's still our brother. We can't do this. Let's talk to him. Let's sit down and figure this out. No, Reuben's plan is gutsy, but not all that gutsy at all. Reuben's plan is, let's not take his life. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. So I'm going to try to defer this a little bit, but I'm not going to get too much into it and tell him that we need to work this out. We'll throw him in a pit. That sounds better than killing him. And his plan, Reuben said this, to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, and I'm going to guess just joyfully stripped him of that. That robe was the symbol of all of this. This is the gift that is their incredible, his incredible thing that they can't have. We strip him of that robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and they threw him into the cistern. Now, the cistern was empty and there was no water in it. We don't know a lot about the size of the cistern or the depth of the cistern. I'm going to guess he was not lowered in there gently as he's thrown in, probably some degree of injury, and then sitting in the pit and listening to conversations going on about him and what they should do. And just thinking to himself, where did I make the wrong turn? Was it in how I talked about the dream? Was it in reporting on them? I didn't ask for the robe. The robe was given to me. Should I have gone to dad and say, well, they need robes too? What about them? Any number of things. Or maybe the direction some others would go of, I have been wrong. This is a great injustice. Poor, pitiful me. As he sits there in the pit. And so there he sits in the pit. As they sat down to eat their meal, in verse 25, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Now, if we will remember back several weeks now, this is not the first time we've encountered the name Ishmael. Ishmael was the child that came to be because, again, God's people tried to take things into their own hands and take control of things, and it caused a big rift within the family. And now the Ishmaelites find themselves again in the story, amazingly being used by God towards his purposes in the end. The Ishmaelites are coming through, heading from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Now, we'll get rid of the headache and the source of our frustration, but will there be any real gain for us? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood. Now suddenly the not killing him sounds great because there's money to be made. His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. Thinking ahead a little And it's difficult when we look at stories like this, because if you're anything like me, Joseph, the whole story of what he does through the book of Genesis, the end here, is one of my very favorite things in Scripture. I would guess for those who are members here, or those who have been around church very much, the story of Joseph is probably pretty familiar to you. You start out with this guy that's a teenager, and he does unbelievable things in life, and we're impressed with him and his faith and all of these things. And I get myself to the question here of these guys who are coming through to Egypt, and Joseph is about to be sold to them. Is there a different path that would lead Joseph to Egypt? Everything about this family has been promised this land that they're living in, and they probably have viewed this as the destination. This is where they're supposed to be. This is where God wants them. And this detour is going to take Joseph instead to Egypt. Everything that's going to happen to him, all the negatives that are going to come his way, including the one that's just happened to him, are all leading Joseph to where God needs him to be to in turn save the rest of the family who will not be there. It's amazing if you think about that story, because so many times we look at the path with the end in mind and don't think so much about the journey to get there. Are we willing to take the journey even if it is incredibly unpleasant and difficult? Is God always going to get us to where he wants us to go the easy way? And the answer to that for most of us is going to be no. There are going to be a lot of difficulties along the way. And for some reason, those are the times we tend to question God the most. Why would God do this to me? Why would God allow these kinds of things to happen to people that he loves? And when I look at Joseph, I think the answer is pretty clear that God has shown all along the way that sometimes the path is going to be difficult, and it says nothing about the fact that his love for you is any less because of that. He loves Joseph and is faithful to Joseph continually throughout this story. And this is the path that is going to lead him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. This plan that he had in the back of his mind is just, it's gone crazy now. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Now, something else we should probably remember about Reuben is Reuben doesn't come about through the favorite wife. Reuben understands all about the favoritism that's gone on in the house. And even though Reuben does it in kind of a cowardly way, Reuben does want to rescue him, and now he's distraught because it hasn't worked out. Then they got Joseph's robe, verse 31, and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to my grave, to my son." So his father wept for him. They probably expected a bit of a reaction, but probably nothing quite at this level. His favorite son was gone, and he is just beside himself in despair. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. And we see in Joseph the beginning of the fulfillment of the dream that he had. Everything that's going to happen in Joseph's life to put him in the place he needs to be in, everything that's going to happen in Joseph's life to allow his family to be saved, comes about as the result of what happens at the hands of his brothers. And we struggle in times like that, I think, because we feel like we're on the wrong end of these kind of stories too often. Life has gotten too difficult, things are too hard, and we feel like God is nowhere to be seen. A phrase we're going to see a couple times over the next few weeks is, "And God was with Joseph." And it's interesting to me the times that God is going to remind us in the story here in Genesis that God was with Joseph, because the reason he's reminded is because what we've just read about doesn't look like God was with Joseph. You lose your job, and God was with you. You lose someone you care about, and God was with you. Financially, things are difficult, and God was with you. You have a struggle with someone in church family, and God was with you. God is with us all the time, ups and downs, goods and bads. And for Joseph, what starts out horribly badly and is the kind of story that none of us would relish happening in our own lives, is the thing that is going to lead to exactly where God needs him to be, to the point where he will have more about him written in the book of Genesis than anybody else. Joseph is going to live an amazing life for God that begins in a very difficult way. So why do we look at that this morning? Because I think all of us have our struggles. And I hope we can start to turn our attitudes around from God is against me at those times and turn our eyes toward what is God going to do with this? How is God going to allow me to show him to others through this? Where is God taking me through this? How is God going to be glorified in this? And what if instead of assuming that God has it out for us, that we start to realize that God loves us more than anything? God loves us so much, in John 3, we learn that he gave his only son for us. And a God that loves us that much is working in our lives to get us to where we need to be. And this morning, if you feel far from him, he doesn't want that. He doesn't want you to feel far away. He doesn't want you to feel like everything in life is coming at you and he is nowhere to be seen. He wants to be a regular part of your life. He wants you to take him on a baptism. He wants you to live life for him. And he wants you to see him at every turn. And sometimes that's harder than others. And I would imagine that Joseph sitting at the bottom of the pit, with as great as Joseph's faith was, probably had moments of wondering exactly what God was up to here, if those dreams would ever see fulfillment. This morning, we can rest assured that God is using the things in our lives, good and bad, challenging and easy, to bring us to who we need to be. And if you feel like you are just lost on that path, he wants you to join in a family that is all trying to help each other along that path. This morning, if you're part of this church family and you just feel distant and far away and there are things you haven't shared and things that you're struggling with, we want to share those things as family. We want to pray for each other. We want to encourage each other and strengthen each other. Or this morning, if there are just things that we can help with in life in some way, and it's not a matter of coming up here and sitting on a front row, if there are brothers and sisters that are close to you here, you just need to pray to God about those things, we ask them whatever way you need to respond, please do that while we stand and sing.